KPCW News Time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Coming up, we'll be speaking with Executive Director of Jewish Family Service, Melissa Zimmerman. Then Park City Council member Ryan Dickey will stop by with a debrief from last night's City Council meeting. Park City Municipal is a KPCW financial supporter. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with Virginia Pierce of the Utah Film Commission. We're anticipating hearing from Cedric Haynes, though, now, from the ABC4 Weather Center. Cedric, what kind of weather we got coming up?
Well, I'll tell you, we've got some interesting weather. You know, today is actually going to be an okay day out there. We're going to have a mixture of sun and clouds. We'll see these temperatures warming up after a chilly start. We'll climb into the 30s and eventually into the 40s this afternoon. But clouds will begin to thicken back up as we go towards our Thursday evening. And by Thursday night, we've got another winter weather event moving into the area. Now, this one's not going to be nearly as strong as what we have been seeing the past couple of weeks, but this one will bring us a chance of some snow showers moving back into parts of the area as we go throughout tonight into your Saturday. So we'll call it increasing clouds throughout the day, with high temperatures climbing into the low 40s, and those winds will be gusty at times out of the south and southwest. And then tonight, we're looking at those snow showers starting to develop, especially, I think, after about 9, 10 o'clock in the evening, as we see our overnight low temperatures drop down to around freezing. And then as we go throughout the night, we'll have those off and on periods of snow showers there for Park City area. We could be looking at snow accumulations of around 1 to 3 inches. I think it'll be closer to 1 to 2 inches, but about 1 to 3 inches of fresh new snow coming up for us as we go into our Saturday. And then we'll have off and on periods of snow showers continuing for our Saturday, with highs right around the lower 40s there for us. Now, in the Heber Valley, we're looking at pretty much the very similar forecast here across the area, with those clouds thickening up as we go throughout today, but mainly dry. We'll see our high temperatures in the Heber Valley today climbing into the upper 40s for highs. And then tonight, we'll see those overnight lows down near freezing, with some of those snow showers developing. Could have a little bit of rain mixed in with it, but I think it'll be primarily snow showers as well for the Heber Valley, with those temperatures dropping down to around freezing. Again, could pick up an inch, maybe 2 inches of snow accumulations in the Heber Valley with the system as it moves on through, and we'll have those snow showers for the first half of your Saturday, tapering off by Saturday afternoon into the evening hours. So that'll be our little taste of winter. And then after that, we're back to spring-like weather here for our Sundays. We're looking at partly cloudy skies, temperatures starting off in the mid-20s, but highs will climb back into the mid-40s across Park City area, and we're looking at highs in the low to mid-50s in the Heber Valley. And then as we go into next week, it's just off to the races with the warmer temperatures. We're talking about Park City seeing temperatures climbing into the low 50s for highs as we go into your Monday. How about high temperatures near 60 in Park City by the time we get towards your Tuesday? And we're in the mid-60s for highs as we get towards your Wednesday, with lots of sunshine. So definitely a real true taste of spring coming in for next week in Park City. The Heber Valley, a very similar conditions, partly cloudy skies as we go into your Monday, highs near 60. We're in the mid-60s on Tuesday with lots of sunshine. And then by the time we get towards your Wednesday, highs nearing 70 degrees. Are you ready for that?
Yeah, it sounds like the beginning of the end of ski season, Cedric. Are we seeing any cold stuff coming out in the weeks to come?
I'm glad you asked that question. I was just looking at some new data that was coming in, and it does look just after this period of very warm weather. It looks like by next weekend, we could have another colder storm system with maybe more snow chances and colder temperatures. So I wouldn't completely say that we're done, but we're definitely going to get some nice breaks, I think, in between these storms from now on.
Not time to clean off the golf club yet.
Not just yet.
All right. Thanks, Cedric. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Okay, let's see what this increasing warm trend is going to do to things in the backcountry. On the phone, I've got Greg with the Avalanche Center. What do we got going on this weekend first?
Yeah, good morning. You know what? Those of us in the snow and avalanche business are going to try not to think about next week for now. And, you know, it's been an amazing run. It's been a phenomenal week of conditions, lots of snow. And one thing we've done at the Avalanche Center for avalanche forecast for the Salt Lake Mountains, and when we say the Salt Lake Mountains, we're including the Park City Ridgeline, the Park City Mountains as well, is we have dropped our persistent weak layer problem. We've had it since November, and it doesn't mean it's gone away. It just, we're calling it dormant. It's just been unreactive. So it may return, and it may return next week with all that warm weather. But The nice thing is that for now, we're not concerned about it. It's silent, it's sleeping. And that means that we can just focus on avalanche problems that are more in your face. So today we're going with generally a low danger, although upper elevation slopes facing northerly through east, even some southeast, have some pockets of wind drift. Over the past 24 hours, we've been having these westerly winds. They've been blowing from the southwest, west, and then overnight in the northwest. They'll be shifting back to the southwest today. So it's been drifting some snow into those upper elevation slopes. People are finding wind drifts generally 6 to 12 inches deep, although some areas in the up around 11,000 feet, they've been up to 2 feet thick. So generally a low danger, but you want to watch for slopes that have recently been wind drifted, and there's a moderate danger on those slopes. And yeah, the storm overnight, it's looking better. You know, it was looking only like an inch or two, but you just heard Cedric talk about it. We're expecting a little bit more snow. You know, I think some areas could, they do well in northwest flow, such that the cottonwoods could even get like 6 inches out of this. Mm. So fingers crossed. Yeah, then a big warm up tomorrow. And just telling folks that when we do get a big warm up like that, it's going to be a real shock to the snowpack. Yes. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens next week. But, you know, for now, enjoy the, we've had great snow this past week, and good snow at least for the next day or two. And moderate danger with generally a easier to manage avalanche problem.
Okay, Greg, thanks much. And we'll be touching base obviously next week as things warm up.
Will do. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
So Monday is the final day of referendum signature counting at the Summit County Clerk's Office. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the decision on whether Dakota Pacific's development agreement goes to a countywide vote might not be until June.
Monday will have been 21 days since the clerk's office received the final batch of signatures seeking to overturn a controversial Kimball Junction development. Summit County Clerk Eve First says her final verified signature count will be posted to the Utah Lieutenant Governor's website at 9 a.m. Tuesday. 7 Summit County residents have petitioned to put the county's controversial development agreement with Dakota Pacific Real Estate on the ballot this November. They've previously told KPCW they expect to meet the 4,554 signature threshold. With a few days to go, the clerk's office has verified more than 3,200 signatures, over 70% of the requirement. First says state law allows each voter who signed the petition 45 days to remove their signature after it appears on the Lieutenant Governor's website. After that, her office is allotted more time to calculate whether residents got enough signatures across different areas of the county to put the council's deal with Dakota Pacific on the ballot. First says the final deadline to rule one way or another is June 23rd. The sponsors told KPCW they submitted almost double the number of signatures the clerk's office says it's verified so far. When the group submitted the first 25 signature packets, First said 21 of them were invalid, in part because of how they were bound. That could have invalidated up to 2,100 signatures. However, the sponsors say every packet they turned in was compliant with state code and said they would challenge First's finding in court if needed. During the effort, Dakota Pacific formed a political issues committee, Wasatch Back Future, to hire door-to-door canvassers and others to advocate against signing the referendum. The signature-gathering effort, dubbed Protect Summit County, was staffed by volunteers. The development at the center of the dispute is a proposed 725-unit neighborhood, nearly half reserved for local workforce. It included a public-private partnership to build a new Kimball Junction Transit Center, park and ride, pedestrian bridge, more affordable housing, and a plaza where the library sits now. Dakota Pacific would pitch in $3.75 million to parts of the partnership, with Summit County, High Valley Transit, and the Utah Department of Transportation sharing the rest of the cost. Separate from the referendum, two other processes are underway that could let Dakota Pacific break ground anyway. One is incorporation. The company filed to form a town out of its 50 acres surrounding Skullcandy's headquarters, giving a self-appointed board land use authority, circumventing the county. Dakota Pacific might not be able to build for at least a year if it goes the incorporation route. The Lieutenant Governor's office says the next step is engaging consultants to see if the town could raise enough taxes to provide services. The second option is using Senate Bill 26. Bill sponsor Senator Wayne Harper, a Republican from Taylorsville, says it codifies the agreement the county and developer made in December. Under SB 26, which took effect March 12th, Dakota Pacific only needs administrative approvals from the Summit County Planning Department to build. If the company is successful in either pursuit, it could circumvent the referendum. Summit County's a financial supporter of KPCW. I'm Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Joining us by phone is Executive Director Melissa Zimmerman. Good morning, Melissa, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Melissa, I understand that the food pantry operation has seen a bit of a spike in demand. Let's start by talking about the basics of the food pantry operation. How does the Loblaw Food Pantry work?
Sure. So our Alex and Sally Loblaw Food Pantry is open Monday through Friday for 2 hours each day. Monday through Thursday, we're open 1 to 3 and 11 to 1 on Friday. People typically start to line up outside the building an hour before we open. We have an incredible food pantry coordinator who manages operations and a wonderful volunteer coordinator, which is crucial because we rely so heavily on volunteers in the pantry. We consider ourselves a zero barrier pantry. We don't need to ask for proof of income or anything else. If someone shows up and they need help with food insecurity, we ask their name, the number of people in their family, and they receive food, no questions asked. We offer non-perishables and staples, but we also receive fresh produce and other items through the grocery rescue program. We also do our best to have diapers, wipes, other supplies on hand, but we really rely on donations for those things. We do have an Amazon wish list people can help us with, too.
And on a typical morning, how many people will go through the food pantry?
Right now, we're seeing more than 60 people a day come through and, you know, representing households of, you know, up to 8 or 9 at times.
Have you seen a change in demand over the last year or so?
Absolutely. We've seen a huge increase in demand, nearly 200% increase from February of 2024 to February of 2025. In January 2023, we served an average of about 550 people per month. We're now serving over 3,000 people per month when you look at the number of people associated with each household. So we're seeing a huge increase.
And do you run out of food every day? In other words, by the time those people go through the line, have they basically emptied the shelves?
Not necessarily. We get shipments a couple times a week. So we're usually not completely wiped out after each day. We're stocked up to be able to cover a couple of days.
And are you typically able to serve everybody who got in line that morning?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are days, you know, that we're now staying open a little bit later just because people are still in line and we won't turn them away. If they're in line during those open hours, then absolutely we will feed them.
Do you have any sense as to the reason for this spike in demand?
You know, the only thing I can think about is really just the increase in grocery costs and housing. I feel like families are being backed into a corner, and there's not really any relief. So, you know, they're having to look at prioritizing things like medications, you know, healthcare costs, and it's just getting harder and harder. So really needing more outlets to get that help.
You know, there's some sense that I've read that social service agencies like yours have seen something of a decline in demand out of fear of immigration enforcement. That's not something, I take it, that you're seeing.
We're not seeing that at this point, but, you know, I've heard that around town for sure. I think people are afraid to go and seek public assistance in many instances.
Okay, so where does the food come from?
So we get our food from the Utah Food Bank. They supply us with non-perishables, and we're also part of their grocery rescue program. We also partner with Mill Creek Garden Share and the LDS Bishop Storehouse.
Okay, and I take it that the food bank itself, which is the sort of the umbrella that services a number of these pantries, is also seeing a spike in demand across, you know, sort of your co-pantries, for lack of a better term.
Absolutely.
Okay, so obviously you get food from the Utah Food Bank and the other entity you mentioned. What kind of money does it take to run an operation like this, and where does the money come from?
The funding comes from the state of Utah, the Department of Workforce Services, grants, foundations, and generous private donations. It takes a ton of work to run a food pantry. We rely heavily on volunteers. We're always looking for new volunteers to help us, whether it be checking people in, you know, stocking, unloading food, putting bags together for people. Without our volunteers, it really wouldn't be possible.
And I take it one of the things you have to do in operating a pantry like this is sort of inspecting the food to make sure that what you're allowing people to take is at least is edible, like safe.
Absolutely. So we have people checking expiration dates, making sure it's within the range, looking at our produce, you know, always making sure everything is safe to give out.
And where is the facility located?
We're located at 4500 South and 500 East in the Salt Lake area, kind of on the edge of Mill Creek and Murray.
Mm-hmm. And if people listening to this are inspired and want to volunteer, how would they go about doing that?
They can check our website, jfsutah.org. There's information about the food pantry and volunteer opportunities, and then reach out through there.
And before we go on, I'd like to, unless there's anything else you want to tell our audience about the food pantry, I'd like to, you know, to share a little bit about the other social services that you provide.
Absolutely. We have four core service areas. The first is affordable mental health counseling. 75% of our clients pay less than $25 a session. Many pay $5 to $10 a session. We have a robust programs for older adults and caregivers, including programs for individuals with dementia. We have an emergency financial assistance program as well, and then, of course, our food pantry.
And have you seen similar spikes in your other services that parallel what's going on with the food pantry at all?
I think we definitely have in what we consider our safety net programs, which include the food pantry and the emergency financial assistance, as well as some in the mental health counseling. Emergency financial assistance, the demand has gone way up. And we provide people with assistance with for things like rent, utilities, mortgage payments. We've seen a huge increase there as well.
And again, if they want to learn more about these various services, they could go to that website?
Yep, jfsutah.org.
Okay. Melissa, thanks for spending time with us. Anything else you want to touch on before we go?
I don't think so. I'm so grateful for this opportunity and for everyone in the community who supports us.
Thanks, Melissa. We'll be right back after this. Well, as the deadline nears for Heber to decide whether to keep or abandon ranked choice voting, city council members are asking voters for their thoughts. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has the details.
The Heber City Council says it's gathering comments from residents about what method of voting they prefer before it decides how to run the 2025 municipal election. The city will also share information to educate voters about ranked choice voting in case Heber decides to continue with that system for a third election. Ranked choice voting eliminates primary elections and instead lets voters rank as many candidates as they like on their ballots. In the most recent Heber City Council election, that meant evaluating up to 11 candidates. If no candidate secures over 50% of votes in the first round, the last place candidate is eliminated. Anyone who listed that candidate as their top pick then has their second choice vote tallied. That process repeats until one candidate has a majority. Council members inquired about a citywide survey, but Heber's communications manager, Ryan Bunnell, said there's not enough time for that.
You know, a third party, non-biased contract would be the best way for us to say that this is an unbiased result. We don't have time for that.
He said he doesn't want to use a social media survey because he's worried people outside Heber will respond and the results might not be representative of the city's overall population.
It has to be auditable, you know, because it's sacred. This is a sensitive topic, so I want it to be transparent.
Councilmember Yvonne Barney said she thought there could be value in a social media poll, not into the school district's recent surveys about the new high school name and mascot. She said she's also concerned some voters don't find ranked ballots intuitive.
I hear very few people saying this is easy. If I'm getting phone calls from little old ladies saying, I don't get this, and this is the second time they've done it, I'm not gonna sit there and say, well, you know, maybe you should go see the doctor because you just obviously aren't getting it. That's unfair.
Councilmember Scott Phillips, on the other hand, said he doesn't see a need for Heber to rush to do its own survey. The council discussed a statewide ranked choice voting study from Utah Valley University, which was used by the Park City Council in its decision to adopt the system this year.
There's data that's available. We can look at the data and it's unbiased. It's from a university. It's just stating, here's the facts. Here's the surveys we conducted.
The survey showed preferences were fairly even for ranked choice versus traditional single choice ballots. More than 75% of UVU's sample of Utah voters surveyed in 2021 and 2023 found ranked choice ballots easy to use, and a majority said they enjoyed using ranked choice voting and wanted it to continue. However, researchers said the pilot program is too new to draw definitive conclusions about voter preferences. The Heber City Council ultimately decided not to rush into a survey of its own. Instead, council members asked voters to reach out and share their opinions via email at citycouncil@heberut.gov. The council will pick which voting method to use during its meeting April 15th. In 2018, the state implemented a ranked choice voting pilot program that runs through January 2026. A bill to extend the program died during Utah's 2025 general session. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Park City Artists Association is hosting its second annual Spring into Art Showcase, featuring the works of 29 local artists. KPCW's Leslie Thatcher has more.
Karen Kendall, who does abstract landscape using mixed media, will have her work on display. She says the artwork spans various mediums, including glass and metal sculpture, painting, jewelry, textiles, and photography.
A little something for everybody. It should be a really good show. And about half of the artists are new from last year, too. So it'll be a different variety than what was shown last year if people had gone last year. They'll see some new things.
Kendall says the association rents hotel conference rooms because there are so few opportunities in town for artists to show their work for sale.
There's not, honestly, a lot of opportunity for local artists to display except for some of the shows, things that the Arts Council might put on, like their show out in the Red Barn and Oakley. We have an opportunity, obviously, to apply for the Kimball Arts Festival. And then we have the Create PC Gallery. So there's a lot of local artists, all local artists in the Create PC Gallery, but it's limited.
Other artist opportunities include the Silly Sunday Market and the Park City Library, which also hangs local artwork. Spring into Art runs Friday to Sunday at the Doubletree, also known as the Yarrow Hotel. The artwork will be shown from 4 to 8 p.m. on Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Saturday, and 10 a.m. to 4 on Sunday. Admission is free. Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Council held its regular meeting last night. Here in the studio to talk about it is Councilmember Ryan Dickey. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. You guys met for a while yesterday, didn't you?
Well, we always meet for a while. Yesterday was, I think, 6 hours, so could have been worse and has been worse.
Well, I know the afternoon session began with some discussion about the budget process. I saw a staff report that sort of anticipated, quote, the most conservative budget in several years with a year of relative austerity. Why does the city anticipate a drop in revenue growth?
Good question, and probably austerity overstates things a bit. You know, this isn't Greece in 2010 or something. We're healthy, and we're going to have a $95 million operating budget. But reality is, when we look at our sales tax forecast, we expect to be up about 3%, and that's on a trend line of being up about 6% year over year for the last decade. So we don't want to just assume this ride of high sales taxes is going to continue. So we see expense growth that is above that 3%. So between inflation and just our hard costs of materials and supplies and salt and equipment, that's going to be up beyond that 3%. Increases in insurance, generalized inflation, uncertainty in the economy. We just want to budget in a conservative way, which is what we always do. But looking at that forecast to make sure we don't get out over our skis.
So you mentioned insurance. Is one of the big drivers sort of the healthcare insurance for employees? Is that one of the things that's really pushing it?
It's health insurance, which, although good news there, initially looked like that was going to be up almost $2 million. But our amazing HR director, Sarah Mangano, she took the initiative to RFP that health insurance. Actually got about $1 million out of the cost, so it's less of an emergency than it
So that 35% number we saw in the staff report, it's going to be less than that.
That's going to come down.
Okay. So, you know, like anybody, you've got sort of an increase in costs and a revenue growth that doesn't match that increase in cost. Let's talk a little bit about some of the strategies you expect the city to try to implement to try to manage things.
It's a few things. We're going to be conservative on personnel, so where we have open positions and positions that are duplicative, we're going to look for efficiencies on that side. We want to use technology a little better, so looking at kind of going back to our KPI model and efficiency and what are we achieving from a quality perspective, but also efficiency. We're going to experiment a little bit with AI, and we're going to say, what can we do to serve our residents better by using these new tools, and where do we have overlapping technology among departments that we can consolidate? So looking at efficiency in the organization, you know, not so much from a big reduction in force, but just trying to holding the line on personnel. Personnel is two-thirds of our operating budget.
You know, I saw the AI reference in the staff report, and I was sitting here trying to think about how that could possibly work. Do you have any, I mean, like, take it down to, like, the junior high school level, which is where I think. How would AI actually help things? What are they thinking? Do you know?
Well, we haven't talked about it, so probably the limits of my imagination and yours
are
where we could go. But a lot of, I think, AI is used in sort of an anticipatory way. Where do we expect problems to occur? Where do we expect issues are happening in town? Mm-hmm. A lot of what we do in town, we're as proactive as we can be, but the nature of the beast is it can be complaint-based. What if we could anticipate an issue with roads, anticipate issues in stormwater, and be a little more proactive? I think that's the kind of thing you can do with AI.
So I guess one of the things that a city has to do, more often at the philosophically or a little bit, but is to manage spikes. And so one of the things I take it AI could do is help you better predict where spikes might be and maybe budget to that? Is that that the kind of thing you're thinking?
I think that's right. And then on the customer service side, if you go to that city website, we have a good website, but there is a lot of information there. It could be hard to find things. AI, we see bots living on websites that can converse with people in a more fluent manner. It might be easier to find information or get help you need without going to City Hall or waiting in a line or making a phone call. It'll be fun.
Although, as you know, sometimes those bots are pretty frustrating when you really want to talk to somebody who can actually understand your problem. So it's a fine line that you guys are going to have to experiment with, I take it.
It's true. You know, that tough thing about AI is it seems to be right 85% of the time, but when something is important and it's going to be wrong 15% of the time, it seems like that's that big hurdle that AI is trying to get past.
I know you guys talked about the Child Care Scholarship Program yesterday. Can you remind a listener about how that program works?
Yeah, there are a few pieces of it. The council budgeted $1 million last year to address this fiscal cliff that we saw coming in child care. Ended up expending about $350, so it didn't go up to that full million. But it is scholarships that are income-based, so that we don't want our residents being cost-burdened beyond 10% of their income on child care, to keep things simple. We have subsidies to providers to accept Division of Workforce Services subsidies. So there's state money that families just weren't capitalizing on to bring that money to our providers in town. So some of that was awareness, some of that's language, some of that is the difficulty for providers in accepting it. There's complexity to getting that grant. And so we incentivize providers to accept the grant, and we saw the uptake of that double. So and of course we provided a facility in the library to expand capacity. And it has been a massive success. We've seen about 100 families
take advantage of it
to get tuition subsidies. We've seen two new child care centers open in town. Capacity has increased. We're not taking credit for all that. The school board is a big help expanding capacity for 3- and 4-year-olds within the school district. So a big success, especially for that over 3-year-old segment.
Over 3-year-old or under 3-year-old?
Over 3. Under 3 is where we're struggling, and that's what we talked about last night. We don't have enough capacity for toddlers. They're more expensive to serve. The teacher to child ratio is really low. I think it's 1-4. So you have a need for a different type of facility and a higher operational cost. So when they came to us last year to talk about the child care need, it was really on the operations side. You know, the city's good at building stuff. We say, oh, you need a building, we can build you a building. We have property. They said, it's the operational cost of employees and staff. On the toddler side, there is actually, and babies, there's really more of a need for facilities too. We need space in addition to the operational costs. So we asked staff to bring us back a work session to say, what else can we do to address that segment?
And you started with this $1 million allocation. How long is that going to last? I think you mentioned that the $350 has gone through so far. Do you expect the remainder to last through the end of next fiscal year?
About through the middle is what we heard. So we're going to need to make another allocation. So we did direct staff, when the budget comes back, to make sort of a base level allocation that matches what we do today, so that those families going into next year know that, you know, this program isn't going away. The support is there. But then we're going to look at what else we can do.
So again, I guess the city deems the pilot a success and expects at this point to be able to continue it.
Absolutely. I mean, we're recognized nationally. We've gone to Washington, D.C. We've gotten awards for a small place like this to be doing something this innovative. This child care problem is almost everywhere. And to have people looking to Park City, I mean, it's a really cool thing.
It's pretty cool. Do you have a sense of the breakdown as to who is using the phones? That is, residents versus those employed in the city that aren't residents?
It's about the two biggest segments are residents and workforce, and they're a little over 40% each, I think, and then some folks are both. So, you know, it's interesting. I got to say, I said it last night, I was a little bit of a skeptic going into this. I'm a believer in markets, and I look at this as ultimately a private service delivered by the free market. And sometimes when the government intervenes in a market, we can make the problem worse. But I've really come to understand this as sort of part and parcel with this affordability problem we have that relates to housing. We love our small town character. We don't wish for lots of density. We came here for what we have, and our residents don't. We don't want to become a city. But what comes with that is, I think, sort of an obligation for us to mitigate the effects of not building more housing. So 88% of our workforce is driving in, and we don't have, we need to help them with childcare. We choose not to build housing. We help with, to have density, we help with affordable housing. We're essentially mitigating two problems that are central to affordability that are created by regulation at the end of the day. So it's been an enormous success. I think we always want to be skeptical when we intervene, but I think this is a program that we can be really proud of, just like we're proud when we help out on the housing front.
Okay. Anything else on childcare before we move on?
I think that's it.
Okay. I know that there was some discussion of an FHA wildlife crossing grant. What is that?
That was a staff communication. We are applying for a grant. This issue of wildlife on 224 is sad, and we want to do something about it. There's talk about a wildlife crossing. We've done things, but the problem persists. So we're applying for a grant. It's a non-construction grant, but it just looks at, it's a study of where would you put a crossing, how would it work, what's required. I think last time we talked about what's involved in building a crossing was maybe 21 or 22. And it was, miles of wildlife fencing surrounding a crossing. UDOT is not open to an overpass. There's complexity in doing it. There's emerging technology. Do we have to build a crossing? Are there other things we can do? Is there radar? Are there alerts for wildlife? So looking at all the ways to mitigate wildlife, and specifically if it's going to be a crossing, what's required and where does it go?
I mean, when we're talking about a crossing, are we talking about like literally an overpass or a tunnel?
An underpass.
Underpass. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously pretty expensive.
I'm sure that it is. I don't know how much.
Haven't gotten that far yet.
We had a tunnel on our last agenda, and it's a pedestrian tunnel for $15 million.
Yeah,
these are the kinds of things, though, that there are grants out there. A lot of this stuff tends to be grant funded. There's been a federal program. There was a state program. I think, like all these things, we can get help. But I think it's just looking at the totality of the mitigation. What are all of our options, and then what does it take to do it?
And the next step is to sort of formulate a grant, a sort of a specific request. Is that what happens?
Yes. Okay. Yes. We directed staff to go out and get that grant, and also support an existing grant project in California.
Okay. So we've talked about 224 and the animals. Let's talk about 224 and the buses.
Okay.
Did the issue of the BRT widening come up at all last night?
No, it did not come up.
Okay, so where are we on that?
Well, I know last week our transportation liaisons and staff and the mayor met with UDOT. That was our next step that we directed from last time we met, to really understand the risk to this project or to the grant in modifying the project. We did have items on our agenda last night related to electric buses and related to the library, where federal grants are at risk because all the uncertainty that's happening federally, where even approved funding, which just hasn't been expended yet, is getting cut. And so when you look at a project as sizable and that's been in the works for 10 years, like that 224 BRT, as backwards as it sounds, even if we go to the federal government and say we want to actually cut costs from this project, not widen a road, you draw attention to the project, you change the requirements, there's not a lot of certainty about what's happening in Washington right now. So we don't want to upset the apple cart by changing the project. But UDOT is really, these grants, these federal grants, will come through UDOT. UDOT can tell us the risks.
Okay.
And so getting to a better understanding, one, of the risks of changing the project, and two, we've asked for a better understanding of the cost savings that are specific, or sorry, the time savings specifically related to that section of road. I drive that section of road every morning. It clears up after the canyons quite a bit, and you tend to have free flow traffic after the canyons. There's congestion for sure. We wish you could, there were no cars, but there are. I think at the end of the day, when it comes to that BRT project, it's going to be this a little bit of a gut check about the future. We can ask for all the studies in the world about what's traffic going to be like in 2050. We don't know. We don't know what the right assumptions are. We don't know how much parking will be at the resorts. It's a gut check on probably a piece of infrastructure that we don't really need today, but that we might not need in the future. Do we want to go make that investment knowing that it's going to be probably really difficult to ever get a second bite at the apple? And so I can't sit here and tell you what the right answer is, but I think we need more information, and it's a difficult problem to solve.
And it's been going on, as you say, for a number of years. What's it going to take to drive to a conclusion? What do you expect that process to be?
Well, I hope in the next few months we're going to have a decision. We can't. The one thing we can't do is slow down the overall project. It's too important. It would put it too much at risk. So we do need to make a decision, and we do need to collaborate. High Valley Transit, Summit County, Park City. You know, I've been around long enough to remember the days when we didn't get along that well, and when personalities clashed, and we sort of really fought, you know, pretty specifically for our own narrow interests. And those weren't good days. I mean, everybody wanted it to be better, and I think we've really improved our regional relationships. It's been a focus of the mayor. It's certainly been a focus of mine. We need to be collegial and collaborative and get around the table together. And that points the finger at us as a council. That points the finger at High Valley Transit and Summit County. We're all guilty of getting a little passionate about the things that we care about, and that's usually a good thing. But we got to make sure to stay in the boat together and go get this project done.
And row in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. You mentioned the library. Was there some concern expressed about potential grants or other funds that come to the library being threatened?
Yes, there's a federal library board. I'm going to use the wrong words, but it's sort of a federal level library board that provides grant funding and resources for local libraries that has been caught up in DOGE, and so there's a question about whether some of that would continue.
Was there a final vote on ranked choice voting last night as well?
There was. Yes, okay. We approved ranked choice voting for the upcoming election. So we passed a resolution to direct the lieutenant governor that we are opting into the pilot.
And do you in fact believe that Park City voters are as intelligent as Heber City voters?
I believe Park City voters certainly think they're as intelligent as Heber voters, and I think they're correct. So, you know, I think ranking things in order is something. You know, when I pass the time driving with my kids in the car, it's one of our little games. They'll say, "What are your top five flavors of ice cream?" Or you just pick something out of the air. Kids love to rank things. My kids are 5 and 8, and they have no problem with it. And so I truly believe that the voters of Park City are going to be able to figure it out.
Well, it's going to be an interesting experiment, and I guess there's going to be a fair amount of education that's going to happen between now and the election.
We are. We're going to push out a lot of education. We're going to help voters understand that the simplest way to understand it is as an instant runoff, and that's really what it is, that we used to have a primary and then come back for the general. That's just all going to happen at the same time. That's fundamentally what the change is.
Okay. Ryan Dickey, anything else to touch on before we let you go?
Yes, two things I need to remember. Tuesday, State of the City, 6:30 in the Santee Auditorium. We're going to have a great program, and we're going to have refreshments and goodies afterwards. So a little bit of bribery to come here about the State of the City. And then we have openings on 6 of our boards and committees. This is a great way to get involved with the city. Library Board, Public Art Advisory Board, Recreation Advisory Board, Nonprofit Services Advisory Committee, Police Complaint Review Committee, and the Appeal Panel. Go to parkcity.org to learn more. Again, great opportunity to get involved with the city.
Ryan Dickey, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
All right, thank you.
Right back after this. Utah continues to be a desirable location for film productions. Here to talk about some upcoming productions is Virginia Pierce of the Utah Film Commission. Morning, Virginia. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the big picture. What does filmmaking contribute to the Utah economy?
Oh, so much. I mean, it's direct spend in communities and through places like restaurants and hotels and dry cleaners and, you know, lumber yards, but it's also kind of a cultural impact as well. And I think we all get proud when we see Utah on screen in locations that we recognize.
And do you have a sense of what the annual impact is?
We're on average between $80 and $120 million a year in direct economic impact. And of course, you know, the induced economic impact goes far beyond that.
And it does feel like it's a leveraged investment. What kind of incentives does the state of Utah offer to encourage production here?
We have a great incentive program that we've had for about 15 years, and it's a tax credit program. So it provides a tax credit back to productions that spend a certain amount on Utah goods and services.
Okay. Well, I was tempted to have my producer here, Bill Skinner, play the Succession music before I ask the next question. The big news, I take it, is that there's a new HBO production coming to Utah. What can you tell us about it?
Yes, it's very exciting to have HBO back in the state. They haven't been here since Westworld days. And this is a project by Jesse Armstrong, who, of course, as you noted, is the creator and director of Succession. They're in state right now. They're filming in Park City currently. And it stars Steve Carell and Jason Schwartzman. It's got some really interesting cast and So they're here all month, and I think it actually premieres on HBO this spring, so we'll all get a chance to see it pretty soon.
Now, is that production being done, is any of that being done at the film studio, or are they just shooting outside on location?
They are based at the film studio, their offices and, you know, staging areas, and then they're shooting on location.
Okay, and they'll be here for about another month?
Yeah, I think so.
And of course, and then I understand that The Chosen is filming a season here. What is that program about?
The Chosen, they're actually on season six. They've shot four of their seasons in Utah. It's a popular series from creator Dallas Jenkins. It's about the life of Jesus, kind of a cinematic viewing of his life. And it comes to us, Dallas is out of Texas, but they come and take advantage of the Goshen Jerusalem set out in southern Utah County. So they're going to be shooting there in the spring.
Okay. You know, we can't sort of talk about shooting in Utah somehow, I guess, without talking about Hallmark movies. I take it Haul Out the Holly 3. Is that a Hallmark movie?
It is a Hallmark movie. It's actually the third Hallmark movie that we'll be filming in Utah this year. Haul Out the Holly is a very popular franchise on Hallmark Channel. It stars Lacey Chabert of Mean Girls fame. And they're returning for the third version of this popular series.
Yeah, Lacey Chabert has become sort of a Hallmark regular now.
She has. People love her. She's great.
No. And so where are they going to be shooting that one?
That's up in Salt Lake.
Okay.
They use the same neighborhood, and it's in Cottonwood Heights that they've used for all three.
Okay. And then, let's see. I know we have a couple other Hallmark films. Christmas Roses? Is that a Hallmark film?
Not a Hallmark, but it's a new holiday film.
With a name like that, I had to believe it was a Hallmark film. Silly me. Tell us about Christmas Roses.
It's a sweet script. Local filmmaker John Lyde has been kind of a part of the community for a long time, and this is just another kind of sweet take on holiday film.
Okay. And you mentioned there were other Hallmark films being shot here. What are the other ones?
There's one being shot right now called Home Turf. They're shooting in and around Salt Lake. And then second one, which, forgive me, I cannot remember the title. They all kind of run together in my mind, but that one will take place later this spring. So Hallmark's definitely, you know, gotten a taste of the Utah bug, and they really love shooting here.
You may be the first person to suggest that Hallmark films run together. I don't know. Anyway, I wanted to ask you about Insult to Injury.
Yes, that's a new episodic web series from another local filmmaker. This is a really small project, but it's sort of a take on The Office through a lawyer's office. It's a web series on YouTube, and this is part of our community film incentive program, so it helps newly emerging filmmakers get their feet under them and hopefully go on to produce bigger projects.
Okay. I want to ask you about the Utah Film Trail. What is that?
Yes, we're so excited. We just launched the Utah Film Trail a couple of days ago. This is a project we've been working on for years and years. It's created by the Film Commission in partnership with the Office of Tourism. And it really is a way to connect film lovers with the iconic filming locations around the state, including one right there in Park City. And we've got locations all over the state, and they're marked by some really beautiful steel markers that will hopefully stand the test of time and be there for the next 100 years for people to check out.
I have to ask you about some examples. First of all, do you mark the site where Butch and Sundance jumped off the cliff?
Scene actually did not take place in Utah. I believe that took place in Colorado. It was like one of the only scenes that didn't happen in Utah. But there's some other great locations for Butch and Sundance. Snow Canyon State Park, where they're running from the Chase gang, and another one in Zion National Park, right outside the park, where they're heading to Hole in the Wall. So Butch and Sundance fans.
What about my other favorite buddy movie, Thelma and Louise?
Yes, Thelma and Louise is at Dead Horse Point State Park, which is, of course, where they take their fateful last car ride, and just a gorgeous location, and we're excited that the trail marker is really right at the point where you can look into the canyon. So
while I can't visit the place where you jump off the cliff, I can visit the place where you ride off the cliff.
Okay, yes, sure.
Okay. Anything else you want to touch? Oh, let me ask you this. What do you see as the future of the Utah Film Studio? Do you think that will continue to be a filming location here in Park City?
Yeah, they've been busy lately. They have a couple of productions in-house right now, and I know that they're ramping up for a busy spring and summer, which I can't talk about quite yet, but it looks like things are heading their way.
Good. Okay, anything else you want to touch on before we drive off the cliff?
Nope, that's it. Thanks so much.
All right, Virginia, thanks for spending time with us. The Heber City Council is moving forward with plans to transform City Park, with a caveat that everything in the design proposal is preliminary. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
Heber leaders have long described the downtown park as central to a larger vision of making Main Street a destination for locals and visitors. To come up with a plan for City Park's future, Heber consulted Roger Brooks, who's designed park renovations for other cities and towns with similar demographics and populations. His vision for the most awesome square in the United States includes a splash pad and ice ribbon, outdoor dining, a larger band shell, and more. In total, his ideas would cost an estimated $23 million. On Tuesday, Heber City Council members said they like the high-level plan and voted unanimously to move into the next stage of the park transformation project, refining and budgeting for smaller pieces of the project. City Manager Matt Brower emphasized the council's decision Tuesday steers the plans into a new phase of city brainstorming and public feedback.
Because it is such a large plan, it was thought that perhaps what we would do is come back, accept the plan, and that would then initiate the process of doing detailed design on the plaza. What this means is it's going to be a process that would allow for additional public input at key milestones.
Heber hosted an open house about the park plans in October, where Brooks and city staff shared information with residents about adding amenities to the space and targeting about 250 days of activities per year. Councilmember Mike Johnston said while the park concepts are still preliminary, approving a big picture goal is necessary to make progress.
Not a single dollar has been allocated for this. We're not even approving one thing on it. But it is a vision that we can talk about with the citizens, with the businesses, with our council, with the planning commission, with the staff. It's a place to start.
Brower agreed, emphasizing the cost estimates and timeline will be adjusted based on the city's budget and priorities. Councilmember Aaron Cheatwood shared some worries about Brooks's proposal, laid out in a colorful 134-page document. He said he didn't feel Brooks or his partner, Kerry Smith, who transformed a city park in Idaho, listened to the council's feedback.
I went to a ton of those meetings with Roger and with Kerry, and I feel like when they asked me questions and I gave back my insights, I don't see that anywhere in the plan. It makes me nervous that I didn't see that. And then in all of the pro formas and all of the discussions, it never changes. The same plan is on every page.
He also pointed out the only version of the park transformation shared with the city includes maximum programming and the most significant changes to the park space. He said he'd feel more comfortable if Brooks had also shared the financial impact of the plans with more limited programming or slower phases of construction. Cheatwood also said he would have liked to see renderings of what the park would look like partway through the proposed transformation. Still, he voted to move forward with the concept, saying every aspect of Brooks's proposal will be adjusted and reconsidered as it goes through the approval and funding process. Councilmember Yvonne Barney said she sympathized with residents who are reluctant to see the park change, but she said she also saw an opportunity to restore some of Heber's hometown feel.
Those with the biggest questions are those of us who've lived here for many, many years, but we are trying to find the opportunity to move ahead or open the door for us to have more of what we had before.
Construction is nearing completion on the new band shell at the north end of City Park, as well as the repaving of 200 South. Brower estimates the band shell will be finished by April 1st and the road will reopen by May 1st. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Dana Jones will retire after leading Basin Rec for 5 years. Connor Thomas reports she's buying a boat.
Basin Recreation said in its announcement Thursday that Jones is, quote, leaving behind a legacy of impactful leadership and commitment to the district's growth and development. She took the helm of Basin Recreation during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic in December of 2020.
Now's a good time as any to hand over the reins and see where the next person can take Basin.
Jones's contract is expiring at the end of the year, so she'll officially step down December 31st. Ben Castro, Basin Rec's board chair, thanked Jones for, quote, her leadership, dedication, and hard work.
She's led us through transformation of the organization, growth, and whoever is the next person is going to have some very big shoes to fill.
He says the board will form a search committee next month and work with Summit County's HR department. Jones will be able to mentor the next district director before departing on her next adventure.
A friend of mine and I are going to buy a boat, and we are going to do America's Great Loop, which is a big circle that goes all the way up the East Coast, across through the Great Lakes, down the Mississippi, out into the Gulf, and around Florida, and back up again.
Jones loves to travel and spent 4 years in a motorhome after she retired for the first time from California State Parks, where she worked for 28 years. But she says it will be difficult to say goodbye to the Basin Rec team, and described what she'd want to see in the next director.
I'm just so excited to see where they're going in the future. So I think it would be somebody that, maybe somebody that knows the community if possible, who can help navigate all the growth that's going to be happening. There's some big projects that could be on the horizon for us.
That includes finding a place for a potential new field house and sports fields and managing the flow of people at Basin Rec's current Kimball Junction headquarters. Jones estimates Basin Rec's budget, staff, and programming has increased threefold in the past 6 years. Basin Rec says she led the district through a successful truth in taxation process, the series of public hearings needed to raise property taxes. A Wanship resident, Jones also served on the board of North Summit Recreation. During her tenure, the district also completed a master plan, hired Basin Rec Rangers, expanded Run Amok, and built new parks at Trailside and Willow Creek. Basin Rec's a financial supporter of KPCW. I'm Connor Thomas, KPCW News.